All right, we're in Hebrews chapter 5, and we got down through verse 6 last time, so we want to pick it up from there this evening. So we'll go ahead and start. We'll want to include verse 6 because verse 7 begins with the word who, and if we're going to understand who that is talking about, we need to at least refresh a little bit by reading the verse before. All right, so let's read verses 6 through 10 as we begin this evening. And we'll ask Brother Ted to read that for us. Hebrews chapter 5, verses 6 through 10.
As he said also in another place, that are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplication with strong crying and tears, unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard, and that he feared. Though he was his son, yet learned the obedience by the things which he suffered. Being made perfect, became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obeyed him, calling of God of the high priest after the order of Melchizedek.
All right, so he uses that or quotation from Psalm 110 and verse 4, both in verse 6 as well as in verse 10. So he's talking about Christ here, and in verses 1 through 6, we're getting some major feedback. I'm going to see about turning this down. That helps any. But we were looking last week in verses 1 through 6, the teachings about the high priest, particularly Christ as our high priest. That's the primary subject at this point in the context. But as he was teaching about Christ and his high priesthood, he went back and made a comparison and a contrast with the high priest of the Old Testament of the Law of Moses. And there were some things about the high priest in that time that foreshadowed the work that Christ would do. And sometimes it was because of what they couldn't do. But also we saw that there were things that were very different about Christ compared to those priests that were taken from among men under the law of Moses. So that means Christ, his priesthood, his high priesthood, is after another and a far greater order than that of the Levitical priesthood of the Old Testament law. And we did a little bit of a preview looking ahead to some other passages that are coming up in subsequent chapters, because this particular subject that he's on here, it's going to persist pretty close to all the way to the end of the book. We're going to keep coming back to it, Lord willing. But we spent some time last week looking ahead at some of those passages as it tied into the many of the points that we were seeing introduced here in chapter 5. But among those passages, you may recall when we were looking at a little bit of Hebrews chapter 7, which is a chapter that really focuses on this Melchizedek, because Psalm 110 verse 4 that he quotes right here in Hebrews 5 verse 6 and then again in verse 10 states that Christ is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And of course it also says forever after the order of Melchizedek. So the priesthood after that order is one that is eternal in duration, which is very different than that of the high priest of the law of Moses. And chapter 7 that we saw last time really brought that home or emphasized that again. The high priest of the Old Testament, how long did they serve in that office?
Until they died.
And so they were not able to continue by reason of death, it says. But this one, Christ, God's Son, is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So it's going to be very important and key for us to understand what the Lord reveals to us about Melchizedek, to see how that the order of Melchizedek, which is the high priesthood of Christ, is one that is eternal in duration. I mean, that should be quite clear as to why that would be so important. So there's not much mention about Melchizedek. We're not going to get into all of that quite yet, because that's really what chapter 7 is about. But we know enough just from using the quote from Psalm 110 verse 4, which was a prophecy of Christ and his high priesthood, the fact that it would be eternal after the order of Melchizedek. But just that alone, that quotation alone, lets us know something about Melchizedek and as far as the priesthood that he occupied. He could not have been a priest in the same manner, strictly of the flesh, like the priests of the Old Testament law were. In fact, all those priests of the Old Testament law, as chapter 7 again is going to bring up, I mean, they were in Abraham. I mean, they were within his genes already, as it said, in the loins of Abraham. So from that standpoint, Abraham contained all of the priests, the high priests that were to come after the law of Moses. But Abraham was the one that was receiving blessing from Melchizedek, and he was offering tithes to Melchizedek. And by that, from that standpoint, I mean, who's greater, the one that is being blessed or the one that is doing the blessing? And who is greater, the one giving tithes or the one to whom the tithes are given? And he's going to make a big point about that in chapter 7. So there was the high priesthood of Melchizedek was superior to that of the Old Testament law. I mean, if he were a man, and you think about that, if Melchizedek were strictly nothing but a man like we all are and like Abraham was, then here you would have had somebody that was a contemporary of Abraham that was greater than Abraham himself as a man and as a priest. What does that do then with Abraham as the father of the faithful? Yeah, we'd have to follow Melchizedek. I mean, there'd be no reason. I mean, how much material do we have in the Bible about Abraham compared to Melchizedek? So when it comes to being an earthly example for us to follow, I mean, that's why we have so much about Abraham and why we have to follow him. And we have to be spiritually his children by faith. But Melchizedek, even though we only have those scant few verses in the Bible, those three that are in Genesis 14, Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20, and then that verse there, Psalm 110, verse 4. I mean, those are the four verses that are in, until you get to the book of Hebrews, that's all that's in the Bible about Melchizedek. But that little bit that he tells us has great importance and weight as far as this subject is concerned. I mean, he's not just a man, can't be. Because that would make no sense with all these things that he's pointing out about it. Because then Christ's priesthood couldn't be eternal in nature. He couldn't be following or be a priest after the order of some fleshly man whose priesthood would have automatically ended then because of the fact that he was flesh and strictly flesh, just like those ones that were descendants of Aaron. But the important thing is not going to be all the details about, well, how could this be, and what does this mean? What are the implications? Are there other beings like him? All these kinds of questions that can arise that we don't have answers to, because God just doesn't give that information in his word. But what he does tell us about Melchizedek, we need to believe it because of what it means in terms of Christ's high priesthood, because that's the order that his high priesthood is about. So whatever God says about it, we have to believe and understand. So we'll have much more about him coming up. He's going to be mentioned again as that same psalm is going to be quoted, Psalm 110, verse 4. He's going to quote that in the very last verse of chapter 6 as he then launches into all that he has to say about that in chapter 7, which will be the primary focus of that chapter. So that's why we're planning to reserve the rest of this study as far as Melchizedek himself until we get to that point. But for right now, what we can see is that Christ is a high priest forever. It's an eternal priesthood after that order of Melchizedek. Not in that sense, of course, he's not, his priesthood is not like that of those ones of the Old Testament, whose priesthood could not continue. But then, speaking about Christ then, who, verse 7, now he's going back to, as he puts it, who in the days of his flesh. So when we speak about Christ and his existence, we can't define that by one particular period of time. Now, of course, yesterday happened to be the one day of the year where so many people focus their attention on the beginning of Christ's existence on this earth in the flesh. We don't have anything in the Bible that tells us what day that actually was. Now, from the information that's given, when you had the lambing season, as it was, it would not have been December the 25th. There's no way. It would have been in the spring at some point, but we don't know precisely when. The Lord obviously did not intend for us to know that. That's not the important thing of exactly when it was, so that could be commemorated every year, but rather it's what were the circumstances of it. What does all that mean? Well, of course, he did come in the flesh. He was made in all points like as we are. He fulfilled all the prophecy about being born of a virgin, being of the seed of Abraham, and particularly of through David, of the royal line, to be the legitimate heir to David's throne, and then being born in Bethlehem according to prophecy, going to Egypt, where he was taken to escape Herod's efforts to kill all the children in Bethlehem to try to kill Christ, then being brought up in Nazareth. All those things, there's so many prophecies. All of it was fulfilled. All of that's important. But ultimately, it all comes to this point about what Christ's purpose was for being here in the flesh, made like us in all ways, which we've already seen in chapters 2, 3, and 4, particularly goes to the heart of what his work is now as our high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, to be there to help us in our temptations so that we can overcome, because he is the one that overcame all. So there is the great significance to what Christ, how he was made according to the flesh and always like we are, and what he did while he was in the flesh, and being tempted in all points like we are, yet without sin, and then ultimately in humbling himself and becoming obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Well, and he's going to get to that point, really cover so much of that in what he's going to be bringing out in verses 7 through 9 here. But this aspect of Christ's existence in the days of his flesh, when we think of the existence of Christ, which is where he began this book, the book of Hebrews started with showing us the superiority of God's revelation to us through his Son, the New Testament, compared to that of the Old Testament, which is the Word of God. God spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son. It says, by whom he made the worlds, and all those other things that he brings out about him. But in chapter 1, so much of what we saw there pertained to the description or the teaching about Christ and who he is in every respect. When does his existence begin? I mean, in chapter 1, he's not a being like an angel. He's not one. He is deity. He's divine. He was there in the beginning. He's not created. He was creator. The Father created all things. By whom? By Christ. He, the Father, made the worlds. He created all things by Christ Jesus, his Son. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We know John chapter 1, 1 through 3, that teaches along those same lines, makes the same points. But Christ's existence did not begin when he came to this earth. So he was with the Father in the beginning, and then he's creator. Then the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So there's this aspect of his existence, which as far as the totality of it, of course, is a very brief part, but so very, very important what he accomplished when he was here in the flesh. But in the days of his flesh, now just that statement right there, what does that do with Gnosticism, that particular doctrinal error that was, at the time of the writing of Hebrews, it was probably kind of dawning at that point, but I mean, it was going to be quite prevalent within a few years. By the time you get to the end of the first century, I mean, we're reading books, especially in the book of 1 John, we see a lot about that in 2 John, but what was the basic doctrine of the Gnostics about Christ in the flesh? Yeah. So it contradicted that teaching that Christ came in the flesh. But can anyone who's speaking truth deny that Christ came in the flesh? Whoever denies that Christ came in the flesh is an antichrist, is against Christ. Well, think about it. And here we're about to see some of the reasons why. But already with what we've seen just in the book of Hebrews, to say Christ didn't come in the flesh means what? What are the implications for us? We don't have a captain of our salvation. Because how could he have been made perfect through sufferings if he was never in the flesh? How could he be our high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek? How could he be there to succor us when we are tempted if he weren't in the flesh? Because if he weren't in the flesh, then he couldn't be tempted. What does James 1:13 say about God? Can he be tempted with evil? And in the form of God, when he's not in the flesh, he couldn't be. But Hebrews 2:17 says, in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, like us in the flesh, so that he could be tempted with evil. But then, of course, he was in all points and overcame it. Hebrews 4:15. Every one of them. He did no sin. But that was because he overcame, not because he hadn't come in the flesh. What happens to our sacrifice? What happens to our example? What happens to Christ and his high priesthood? What happens to all of that if he didn't come in the flesh? I mean, there's no point to any of it. There's no Christian religion then. So, verse 7, what did he do in the days of his flesh? So, indeed, he did have days of his flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, John 1:14. It happened. It did behoove him to be made like us in all things. He was. So, he came to this earth and was made like us in every way. And so, he had those 33 years of the days of his flesh and suffered all of the temptations that we face. He overcame them all. Well, that's what he's going to be speaking about right here. Who in the days of his flesh, what did he do? It says, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared. Okay, so what did Christ do in the days of his flesh? Well, if he weren't in the flesh, would he have had any need to, with prayers and supplications and strong crying and tears, be pleading with his Father to save him from death? All right, well, that right there, we can see that the prayers and supplications, those words are very close in meaning. The word prayer has the meaning of being a petition, whereas a supplication is to making an entreaty. Well, those are very, very similar, aren't they? I mean, to make a petition or an entreaty, I mean, that's why often we'll see prayers and supplications that go together. So it's just very shades of meaning apart, not much distance between the meanings of those two words, very close in meaning. Here Christ was making those pleadings and those entreaties of his Father. So he prayed. And he prayed, it says, with strong crying and tears. So were his prayers fervent? Did he pray without ceasing? All those things that we're told to do, he did. And these were the effectual, fervent prayers of the most righteous of men, of course, being at the time of his in the flesh, he prayed without ceasing. He prayed fervently, but there was strong crying and tears to his Father. But what was the subject of these prayers that he's referring to here? I mean, how many things did he ask or pray to his Father? Lots of things. I mean, how many different things do we have example of that Christ prayed for when he was in the flesh? Many, many things. I mean, when he taught his disciples to pray, as he did in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, we see other occasions when he was teaching about prayer and being importune, that is, continually beseeching and asking for things. I mean, he taught them to pray without ceasing. He taught his disciples what things to pray for. Well, did he do the things that he was teaching them to do? He obviously did. And we have some specific examples of it. And one that's very much by implication, meaning it would be impossible that he didn't pray for it. When he came down from the mount after he was transfigured, he took with him Peter, James, and John. The other apostles were down there at the in the town, and there was a man who had a son who was possessed of a devil, and they attempted to cast out the devil. And what happened? They failed. How many recorded failures are there of attempted miracles by ones that otherwise God bore witness to that we're told about in Scripture? That's probably it. I don't know if nothing else comes to my mind of another example of that. That's a very noteworthy occasion there just from that alone, but. Then Christ came along and Christ succeeded. He cast the devil out of that child. Well, then his disciples wanted to know how he could, but they couldn't. And what did he tell them? This kind comes not out but by prayer and fasting. Well, just from what he said right there, what does it imply? What had they not done, but what did he do? And we can understand it did, now if he very publicly, and we know when in John 11 he did publicly out loud before Lazarus was raised ask his Father to do that, and he made the point of why he was doing it out loud there. He wanted everybody to hear that so they would know who was doing that. Did he always do that out loud? Well, if he had done that, I mean, would the apostles like, oh, I mean, don't you think that would have been pretty obvious if he had out loud prayed when they clearly hadn't? Why would they have needed to ask him what the difference was and how come he could and they couldn't? I mean, it seems pretty obvious there that they weren't even aware of him praying at that point. But did he? Obviously he did. How many times did Jesus attempt a miracle and didn't ask his Father to do the work? It wouldn't have happened. So we know he did that. So he would ask his Father to do the miracles, to give him the power to do the miracles. He prayed for his disciples. We know he prayed for Peter's faith. Was Peter the only one of his disciples that he prayed for their faith? We know before he chose his apostles, he was up all night. He prayed the whole night about that before he made that decision. He had to be very precise and accurate in who he was choosing to be his disciples. The 11 righteous ones and the one devil that he chose intentionally. But he had to choose the right ones, all 12 of them, for what their role was going to be in God's work. So he asked his Father, spent the whole night asking his Father for that and prayed for. So there are lots of things that we're told about that Jesus prayed for. He would make requests Well, we're told to make request of all things. Well, did Jesus not do that? I mean, he did that. And so we have a lot of specific examples of it. Well, he's not talking here about all the prayers, everything that Jesus prayed for. I mean, did he need to, with strong crying and tears, ask the Father to do the miracles that he did? Or to give his daily bread? Or to do the works that he did? How many of the things that he prayed for would not have been something that would have been along these lines where it would have involved strong crying and tears? There's a reason this particular, what he was praying for, that he's focusing the attention on here in Hebrews 5:7, involved the strong crying and tears. What was the subject of this particular, these entreaties and pleadings that he was making here with those strong crying and tears to his Father? To save him from death. To be pleading and entreating his Father to save him from death with strong crying and tears. If there was no danger of that death, why would he need to be pleading and entreating with strong crying and tears like he was? So was this death he's referring to, was that something that was a very real and genuine threat to our Lord? It was. And something that he wanted to be saved from. It's very easy for us to read that and then have our minds go back to what happened to Jesus last night on the earth when he went out in the Garden of Gethsemane. And again, he had Peter, James, and John. There were several times when he had many disciples. Of his disciples, how many men were all the disciples that he had were the closest to him? Well, there were 11. We're going to accept Judas there. But the other 11 were obviously the closest to him of all his disciples. Of those 11, who were the closest to him of those 11? There were 3, Peter, James, and John. There were a number of times when he took just those 3 on some special occasions. Well, we just mentioned one of them. When he was transfigured in the mountain, he didn't take all 11 up there, or Judas. He took Peter, James, and John. It was always the same 3. When Jairus' daughter was sick and died in Capernaum, and when Jesus was called to go there and went to the house, and who did he take into the house when he raised her from the dead? Peter, James, and John. When he was in the garden, who did he take with him apart there when he was going to pray? Peter, James, and John. Those same 3. So we have a number of occasions where he took those 3. Of those 3, which one does it speak of, unlike any of the others, that it says that's the disciple that he loved? John. So there was a special bond that he had with that one. He loved them all. And he loved them to the end, as he tells us in the beginning of John 13. But John was the closest to him, as far as that is concerned. But Peter, James, and John, those 3 were the closest of all of his apostles, of all of his disciples. And then he was about a stone's throw from those 3, and he instructed them to pray that they enter not into temptation on that night. It was going to be a night of heavy temptation for all of them. And we know what happened to Peter. He was under very great temptation. And the Lord knew it, and the Lord knew he was going to fail 3 times. He denied the Lord. But there was a lot of temptation that they were all under at that night, but Jesus himself. And 3 different times in the garden when he was there praying, what did he specifically ask for? Let this cup, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But he said, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Now, when they did come to get him, and then Peter struck off the, well, so we could say he failed four. That was the first temptation that he failed there, when he took his sword out and lopped off the ear of Malchus, the high priest's servant. And Jesus told him to put the sword away and said, if he that lives by it will perish by it. But what did he also say at that time? What did he remind Peter? Did he need a sword to help him then? If he needed to get out of that situation, what did he have at his disposal? That all he had to do was ask. He had more than 12 legions of angels, didn't he? If he had said, Father, get them, I mean, what would have happened? I mean, that would have been the end of them all. And of course, what would that mean for us, for all of us? But he wasn't going to do his own will. Was it his desire? Was that on his wish list, the top of his wish list, to be crucified? And all that was going to go along with that?
Yes and no.
Right, yes and no. I mean, it was, yes in that, if that's his Father's will, then yes. And he did it because of that reason. For his Father's sake, for our sake, and all of that. And also for his own sake. But if the Father's will could be accomplished some other way than having to go through that, would he have been happy to do something else? Yeah, I mean, that's why he asked if it be possible, if it were God, if his Father's will, to let that cup pass from him. But he said, nevertheless, not as I will, as you will. And when it was his Father's will for him to drink that cup, he drank it, every drop. But anyway, so he was praying for being saved from that physical death at that time, of that death on the cross, if it was his Father's will. He asked that. It's very easy to read Hebrews 5 verse 7 and then think back and, okay, he's referring to that. But is he? What's going to be very important for us to distinguish or to search into to get the answer to what is he talking about here? What was he praying for, and what happened? What was the result? So there are going to be some words that we're going to have to look at to get God's definition for, to be able to understand this properly. Number one is death. Well, how many kinds of death are there? At least two. There's physical and there is spiritual death. We already know that Christ did suffer that physical death. So, and he did ask his Father if it were possible to spare him from that kind of death, that he was going to die on the cross. But it wasn't his Father's will to save him from that, and so he did it. Since the end of chapter 2 all the way to now, what has really been the subject of speaking about Christ and his high priesthood and as it relates to his time in the flesh? What does it all have to do with? Battling and overcoming what? Temptation. The failure to temptation, succumbing to temptation. What is the temptation? The temptation is to transgress God's law. That's what a temptation is. To do something other than what is the Father's most pleasing in his sight. To transgress God's law is sin. Jesus battled against temptation and he overcame. He did not sin. He was, back to chapter 2, verse 17. He was made like us. It behooved him to be made like unto his brethren in all things, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted. And then chapter 4 and verse 15 again says, for we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. So he keeps coming back to that, and he's actually coming back to it here again right now in this part of chapter 5. when was he making these pleas with his father and these, when was he beseeching him to save him from death? What kind of death? Well, we know he did ask if it was possible for him to be spared from that death on the cross, but that was not his father's will for that. Is that all he prayed about? Was what was he asking his disciples to pray for at the very time? Peter, James, and John, when he took them there in the garden when he was only a stone's throw away from them, what did he ask them or tell them to be praying for? Getting through the temptation to not fail, to not fall in sin. Well, did Jesus only pray that if it was the Father's will, that cup might pass from him? Is that the only thing that he asked at that time? Did he recognize all the temptation his apostles were going to be under, but then did not have awareness of what he was going to be facing? Well, when he was pleading, when he was praying to his Father, what was the sweat like? Yeah. I mean, what kind of stress was he under and why? I mean, it was all that temptation. So he wasn't just praying, let this cup pass from me. He was also asking his Father to get him through all of those temptations. That's been the focus of this. That's why he's able to help us to do that. So that's what he was focused on there. So in that sense, what other kind of death was he? What death would he have been most concerned about being saved from? The spiritual one, that's the wages of sin. The wages of sin is death. Romans 6:23. What happened to Adam when he sinned? The day that he ate there, what was the promise from God that would happen, that would be the consequence in the day that he broke God's commandment and ate of that fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? That you will surely die. Well, he didn't drop dead physically that day, so that was only one kind of death, that he surely died that day. Spiritual, he was separated from God. Romans 5:12 uses that same point and about that same kind of death. So death has passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. It's happened to us. Well, it didn't happen to Jesus. He did not sin, and so he did not die. Did the Father save him from spiritual death? Did the Father get him through all those temptations where he overcame everyone? And how many would there have been, especially at the end, from that last night? From the time when, I mean, they're in that upper room and there's Judas. That the betrayer is right there with him. I mean, would there have been any temptation there to go after Judas? Or to stop him? I mean, Jesus knew it. He said, what you do, go do it. Do quickly. I mean, could Jesus have stopped Judas from going and completing the transaction that was going to lead to his death? He's there seeing this man who was his betrayer, and he knows what he's about to do, identifies him, and then sends him out to finish the work that's going to result in his own horrible death. Would there be any temptation in any of that? And then when all the mob came, and I mean, all the false accusations, the lies, the hypocrisy that he was dealing with, and then, of course, all of the physical things that were happening to him, being mocked, being spat upon, being struck, and then leading up to the scourging and the crown of thorns and the being hit and beat on his head with those thorns there, and then being crucified and all of that. I mean, and some of us were talking the other day about dealing with fatigue. I mean, when you're physically tired, when you're physically tired and weak, does that bear any relationship to dealing with temptation? Yeah, there are other temptations that come in, and some of that gets harder to deal with when you're physically tired. Well, the devil made sure he didn't get a wink of sleep his last night. I mean, he was up all night going through all those trials and all the other things that were happening to him. I mean, so you can think about it. When was the last time he slept before he went to the cross? I mean, it would have been at least a day and a half before when he woke up for the last time. So, I mean, he was physically tired, exhausted, and then all those other things. And there's so much temptation that he was facing there. And if the devil could get him on just one, I mean, how many would it take? But he had to be able to recognize, in spite of all that was there and all of his fatigue and the physical agony, he had to be able to recognize every single temptation that came, every fiery dart that came, and had that armor on and had that shield of faith there to quench it. Well, was he going to be able to do that on his own, or did he need his father's help and strength? And what does it say? The father, what he sent the angels who strengthened him. Doesn't it tell us that that happened when he was there in the garden? So the father responded. Now it was, what kind of strength did he give him? It had to be. All right, well, in this we know from what it says there. So he made these prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death. Was the father able, we know the father could have saved him from the physical death, but was the father able to save him from the spiritual death? Was the father able to provide him all that he needed to get through every temptation? That's who he was asking to do that. How do we really know that's the kind of death that he's talking about that he was being praying to be saved from? And it comes in that very last phrase of verse 7. And was heard in that he feared. So both by telling us the prayer was heard and why gives us the information we need to know exactly what kind of death that he's referring to that he was being saved from there. Which is the context and the subject of this part of Hebrews anyway. Christ and what he did in dealing with temptation and how that's going to help us dealing with temptation. I mean, if this focus were on the physical death that he was asking the Father to be saved from, how would that really directly relate to what we're going through in our lives in the flesh with all the temptation that we're facing? Christ in his battle against temptation to not sin, to not die spiritually, how relevant is that and how directly does that influence or affect what we're going through in a moment-by-moment basis in our lives on this earth? It has everything to do with it. That's the very subject here. The context should also, I mean, that should really guide us right here as far as understanding what he's talking about. But then when he says, he was heard in that he feared. All right, well, number one, heard. What is the definition of a heard prayer? Now somebody said, well, God hears everything. Well, yes, in the broadest and ultimate sense, God hears every word anybody ever utters. When he talks specifically about prayer, though, and that God hears a prayer, God defines that. It's not that we shouldn't be guessing and Brother Johnson is actually using the very words quoting from the passage we want to go to next and see that. 1 John 5:14 and 15. Here God defines for us very precisely what it means when he hears a prayer. He obviously hears all of our words. He heard his son's word. When Christ pled with him to let that cup pass from him if that were possible, did the Father hear those words? Of course he heard the words. It wasn't his will, though, to grant that request. It was his will that his son go to the cross. And so his son obeyed and did it. If this were talking about, well, let's read 1 John 5:14 and 15 to see very clearly what the definition of having a prayer to be heard means. Brother Dave, can you read that?
And this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, and if we know that he hears us, whatsoever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we desire of God.
Okay. And this is obviously speaking in the realm of request for things that aren't promised by God. Because that subject, if we're talking about something that God has promised, and he has promised us many things, are we supposed to ask God to fulfill the things he's promised? Or can we say, well, he's already promised, we don't need to ask? Right. Has he promised our food, drink, and clothes if we'll seek him first, his kingdom and righteousness? Matthew 6:33. That's the same chapter where he teaches us to ask for our daily bread. So are we supposed to ask the Father to fulfill that promise? Yes. We can also look at the first chapter of the book of James in verses 5 through 7. What are we supposed to do if we lack wisdom? We're supposed to ask God, who gives liberally. Well, does he promise to give wisdom? Yes. So are we supposed to still ask for it? Yes, we are. So there are several examples of that, things that we have been promised of God that we are instructed to ask for. Yet with that, in James 1, when it comes to those things that God has promised, now, are his promises conditional or are they unconditional? They're conditional. Are there conditions for receiving wisdom from God? Yes. God tells us there's certain things we have to do for him to be willing to give us his wisdom. Can we circumvent that pathway and those conditions and say, now, I'm not going to do all those things you said I have to do to get it, but just give it to me any way you promised it, and it's going to happen? No. But if we do what God says we have to do, if we meet the conditions, is there any doubt that God's going to do his part and then fulfill what he's promised? What if we doubt them? What if we doubt the promises of God? That's what James 1 talks about. Nothing doubting, because if we doubt in those things, we're like a wave of the sea is tossed. And he says, don't let that man think that he'll receive anything of the Lord. If we doubt his promises when we fulfilled his will and met the conditions and we don't believe he's going to fulfill it, without faith it's impossible to please God. So why would we think he's going to give us anything if we don't believe what he said when he's promised us something? That's the subject there. And so when Jesus says that whatsoever we ask in faith, believing, we'll receive, how important is that phrase, in faith? Where does faith come from? Hearing, and hearing by the word of God. That means, by definition, there's something that we've heard in God's word that God has said that he's going to give us, a promise. Those things, when we ask, we have to believe that he's going to fulfill without doubting. So that's one subject. That's not what he's talking about here in 1 John 5:14 and 15. Here he's speaking about making requests. This would be in the realm of the things that God has not promised. Is it okay to ask God for something he hasn't promised, or should we limit ourselves to only request those things that he's promised? He's told us, Philippians 4, verse 6, to make our requests known in everything. So he wants us to everything that we desire, and wants us to ask of him. Well, that's going to include a lot more things than just what he's promised. So then what? Well, then we have to ask, like Jesus did. Had the Father promised Christ to let that cup pass from him where he wouldn't have to go to the cross? He hadn't promised to spare him from that. So Jesus asked, if it be your will. But if it's not, he said, your will be done, not mine. Well, that's the example that we see of making requests for something that's not been promised. That's what this is talking about. So if it's not promised, we don't have to ask God, if it's your will, if it's something he's promised. It is his will to do that. Then we need to ask him for his help, that we do what he says we have to do for him to then be willing to give us those things. But we don't have to ask God if it's his will to fulfill the things that he's promised and the things that he has stated, which is his purpose. But on the other things, if it's not something he's promised, then we do need to ask if it's his will to do that. In that case, do we know for certain we're going to get it? No. Well, the Son didn't get that request about the cup passing from him. Is there ever anything that we ask that God hasn't specifically promised? Well, we asked the Lord to spare Brother Gene. That was our request on his behalf. Well, it wasn't his will, obviously. And that's going to be the case. I mean, we can all pray that none of us ever die. But what's going to happen to us all at some point if the Lord didn't come first? I mean, eventually it's going to be God's will that we go. Now, when and how and all of that, I mean, all of that's going to be up to him. And we can make requests about those things. Had God promised the disciples that he was going to let Peter out of the prison in Acts 12 after James had been killed? No, and what were they all doing at the moment when Peter was released from prison? They were all in the house praying for that he'd be released. Did God hear that prayer? He heard that prayer, let it happen, and Peter shows up at the house and they don't believe it. They were surprised. We would have been too. But that's what they were praying for, and God heard that prayer for all of them. They were all together beseeching the Lord that. God heard that prayer and granted the request. Well, that's what he says. When he hears, he says, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions we desired of him. So that's what it means when he hears it. When he hears it, if he's heard the prayer, then he grants the request. So if he doesn't grant the request, he heard the words, but he didn't hear it in the sense of that he granted what we asked for. So the definition of a heard prayer in those matters of things that God has not promised here is when he gives what is requested. Well, what does it say about that request that Christ made to be saved from death? He was heard. Which means that request was granted, wasn't it? So that death that he was pleading with the Father to save him from, he was saved from. So was that the physical death? Couldn't be. Another example of this, let's just help us out to see another application or situation where this happened. Luke 1 and 13. Let's turn to Luke chapter 1, read verse 13. Brother Glenn, can you read that for us?
But the angel said unto him, fear not, Zacharias, for thy prayer is heard, and thy wife Elizabeth shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John.
Now Zechariah was quite old, as was his wife. That didn't stop Zechariah from praying and asking God to give him a son. And what did the father do with his prayer? He heard it. And how does God's angel describe or define the hearing of that prayer there? God heard it, and he's going to give it to you. So that's what it means. So we see that definition in 1 John 5, 14 and 15, we see it exactly applied there in that situation and that's Zechariah and Elizabeth, who became the parents of John the Baptist. So, of course, one could ask, would they likely have been the parents of John the Baptist if Zechariah, even in his old age and with his wife being older, hadn't been praying for that? Now, he was praying for it. Was he praying that God give me not just a son, but give me the son that would be the one to prepare the way of the Lord that would fulfill all that prophecy? Do you think he was praying for that? No. But the Lord heard his prayer and gave him what he was asking for and gave him far beyond that. But at any rate, we see that's an example of a heard prayer. Well, Christ was saved from death. What death do we know he was saved from? We know he was saved from that spiritual death. He was tempted in all points like we are, yet without sin. We know he didn't fall to any temptation. He did not sin. So the Father got him through every one. He became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And that's where he's going to go in the next verse about his obedience. So that the subject in verse 7, the death he was saved from, relates directly to obedience. What's the opposite of obedience? Disobedience, which would be sin, which would lead, what would the wages be? Death. That's what he wanted to be saved from. He didn't want to disobey his father. And he didn't. So he learned obedience by the things that he suffered. And then that's what was able to then put him in the position where he could be the author of eternal salvation to all them that obey him. This is all about obedience. Not falling to temptation. Who's the one that accomplished all that and then can help us, in spite of what our past record is, can get us to a different place as far as how we're dealing with temptation, that where instead of falling to it, we can overcome it. That's the point, as it has been for three chapters now. But before we get on into verse 8, that what also relates to that, why did the Father hear his prayer? What was key there? What was one of the key elements to Christ being able to overcome every temptation and the Father helping him to do so and hearing that prayer and saving him from death. He heard him in that he what? Feared. Well, there's another word. We have from the context here, we have to know what kind of death he's talking about. From the context here, we also need to know what kind of fear he's talking about. Did Christ have fear? I know that's a very general question. But just based on what, even if we understood nothing else, if we just asked the very general question, did Christ have any fear? According to Hebrews 5, verse 7, what would the answer be? Yes, he did. He was heard in that he feared. So Christ feared. He had fear. How many kinds of fear are there? You know, there's several. And there's at least one good kind of fear, and at least one bad kind of fear. And it's obvious that Christ had the good or the right kind and didn't have the other kind. We all know Revelation 21:8, I think. You do, even if you don't recognize the reference. It tells us who's going to have their part in the lake of fire. And which includes all liars. But what's the first one that is mentioned in Revelation 21:8? But the fearful. Well, obviously, there's a kind of fear that's going to send us to hell, and that's the kind Jesus didn't have. So there's a bad kind of fear. There's one that he leads off with as saying that anybody that has that's going to have their part in the lake of fire. Well, that's not the kind of fear that he had. That would have been a kind of fear that would have, well, he would have already failed the temptation. He would have already failed in being saved from death. So whatever that is, that's not the kind of fear that he had. Now, there are a number of different kinds of fear. So, can we think of an example of someone that God gives us as an example of having fear that he warns us, don't be like that, and relates it directly to that lake of fire or that weeping and gnashing of teeth, that outer darkness. Who was cast into outer darkness with weeping and gnashing of teeth that feared? In the parable of the talents, what did the one talent man do? He took it and buried it in that. What did he tell his Lord when he was having an answer for what he had done? He said, I feared. He was afraid. So the kind of fear that will cause us to not serve the Lord, that will cause us not to do his will, that kind of fear is, well, that'll get us into outer darkness in the lake of fire. But that's not what Jesus had. Now there's another kind of fear that is not that kind of fear. So we're looking here at least three different kinds. That kind of fear where we're afraid to where we're not going to take action and do the Lord's will. That's inherently evil, that kind of fear. That'll get us to hell. All right, well, let's look at the one that's, we might say, is more in the area of being neutral. A kind of fear that we can have that's not going to, in fact, it can be helpful. It is not inherently harmful. But yet it's something that we can and should grow out of. All right, well, when we think of the word fear, what do we normally think about? When you're afraid of something, something scares you. Well, has he talked about that kind of fear in this, what we've read in Hebrews so far? Well, in Hebrews 4, verse 1, what does he say to do? Let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left as of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Should we be afraid of coming short of the entering into God's rest? In other words, should there be any fear going to hell? Another way of asking that, are there times when being afraid of consequences of doing evil can keep us out of that evil? Can that be a motivator? Is that a legitimate motivator? When necessary, we got several scriptures to back that up that we're out of time to look at. But that's what we want to try to do next time, Lord willing, is look into that a little bit more. But that's the kind of fear we're going to see in the book of 1 John in chapter 4, that he says the perfect love casts out fear. Well, if we have the complete love, do we need to be motivated then out of a fear of the consequences of disobeying the Lord as far as getting us through temptation? Can we grow to a point where having our inner man formed fully in the image of Christ will be sufficient with all that that brings to get us through any and every temptation, where we don't need to be afraid of failing to get us through it? Yeah. What's that? Yeah. And so that's where we need to go with that. But we want to look at that a little bit more next time. But then we have the fear of the Lord, which is a particular phrase, and he teaches us what that is. That fear of the Lord, which is to hate evil, Proverbs 8, verse 13. That fear of the Lord that he teaches us in Psalm 34, 11 through 18, that he quotes also in 1 Peter chapter 3 verbatim. So we know it's something that's always been, still is, and always will be valid, important, and key. Did Jesus love righteousness and hate evil? Well, that's the thing that he quoted from Psalm 45 back in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 9. He says, "Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity." That was a prophecy of Christ from Psalm 45 that he fulfilled. That is the definition of the fear of the Lord right there. Well, did Christ's love of righteousness and hatred of evil have anything to do with him being saved from spiritual death? He was hurt and then he feared. He had such a love for righteousness and such a hatred of iniquity, the Father was able to use that to then help him get through all the temptations. How could Christ have got through all those temptations if he had not had the fullest love for righteousness and the fullest hatred of iniquity? So that was, and again, that fits no other context than him praying for to be saved from spiritual death. So we'll want to look at that a little bit more before we then get to verses 8 and 9 and understand what he's teaching there about that obedience that is learned and being made perfect and how that's going to lead to our eternal salvation. So Lord willing, we'll continue with this next Wednesday night.